we're not quite the shortest day of the year, but we're meeting a little bit earlier because it's 1 a.m. for Susu and for Yelena, I think. So we're going to actually work through this meeting a little bit differently, which is I'm going to request that everyone actually do their self-introductions in the chat and introduce yourselves. The usual questions are who you are and how you came to systems, and maybe if you know Susu. So if people could, I'll just pause for a minute. If people could actually find the chat, I actually can't find mine now. Where's mine? And just say hello.
Go first. How did I get my first one? Okay, David, just tell me when you want to start.
Well, that sounds like a good time to actually do that. So let me stop the share here. And actually, maybe what I should do is actually explain the share first before I do that. So the interesting thing about bringing Susu on for a talk, although I've collaborated with her quite a lot since. So the longer history is that in 2010, 2011, I was teaching in the Creative Sustainability Program in Finland, and then I had to fall out of that, and Gary took over the course, and that was also when Susu started back in Finland. And so the interesting part about working with Susu is she's doing so many things, it's often hard to figure out exactly what she's doing. And so what I've done is on this one photo, this is one of the things that she's done, which is through, and I'll let her explain a little bit about it, but it's kind of like this is a non-linear way of doing systems education and getting the community involved. Our speakers for today are Susu Nosala, who is a professor at Tongji University in Shanghai, and Yelena Susis, who is in Switzerland and was on the original team. They've just incorporated in Switzerland. And so we are, in effect, getting a very, very recent news from the two of them. And so I'm looking forward to an update on what Susu has been working on. And I'm actually going to invite her to go ahead. Susu.
Okay, thanks, David. Yes, okay, so lovely to see you all here and hear you and read what you've been saying. If you don't know very much about me, I think many of you do. Yes, so I'm working as a professor at Tongji University right now in Shanghai, but I'm physically based in Helsinki because, well, because we can't get back into the country. But I'm due to go back in March, which is why we had to flip the meetings around and do this in February. There's a long history in and from starting from Melbourne University, RMIT in Melbourne, Aalto University, and social complex adaptive systems is my focus. It has been for quite some time. And if you really want to comprehend the sort of things that I actually stitch it all together with, the red line, the thin red line, or the thin thread, the red thread, is really tacit knowledge networks. And I do a lot of that work through many different aspects of what I do, which is why David says I do so many things, but in actual fact, it all has method to the madness. I've been involved in interdisciplinary work extensively for many years, and a colleague of mine reminded me that I might want to discuss about, just mention the fact that one of the reasons why I even know David and Gary is because of Ranulph Granville, who was a mentor of mine back in RMIT days, and because he was a professor, visiting professor there. And I got to know everybody actually in the States and go through all that whole process many, many years ago because of Ranulph. And he was a really great mentor. And he whilst he seemed very scary to other people, I always found him fascinating and quite interesting and challenging, but in a really great way. So that kind of got me onto that whole process. So coming up to speed, Aalto University, that's right. The last time that David and I actually crossed over and worked together was January of 2016, just before I went to Shanghai, actually, later that year. And at that stage, we'd already done 5 years of crossing over, which was a really nice pedagogical process that had built up. And we discovered over a period of time that if you're going to do sort of create a space for systemic learning, you ought to not hit people over the head first up, which means that you have to kind of come through it through stealth. We found that that was a really good way of actually introducing people into the process. So that was the mindset programs, which was sort of systems, but without systems. So introducing it, creating a mindset, creating a space, and then introducing the systemic courses one and two, which then, as David said, was Gary and David who introduced that in the first place to RM at Aalto University. And so moving on to Tongji, then this is where we actually, David has visited actually Tongji multiple times since 2016, 2017. I think it's 2017 when you physically came over. Yes. And he's been over many times and has done many projects with us. And we had hoped that Yihan Chen would be with us. I don't know if he is.
He actually is.
Hello, Yihan. I will actually bring Yihan into this conversation as well, because he's quite critical in this process. So we wanted to actually start. I started this because of the interest in doing a multi-trans interdisciplinary process for creating a space for systemic learning and practice. Because practice is always difficult. We all know that. It's very difficult to apply and get people to do practice in the field. And also training, how to do that in a longitudinal manner. So these were all the elements that started that whole process of why Create a Systemic Research Platform even came into being, was because we had so many different people coming at it from many, many different angles and wanting to look at some key elements about community of resilience, different ways of investigating capabilities, processes, and properties about systemic thinking and systemic processes, systemic projects, and problem-based learning. So all of that together was sort of like the kickstart for all of that in 2016, 2017. So during that time, working in China has been a really interesting process. As Yelena will be able to attribute to that, because it requires you to comprehend your environment in quite a different way in some cases. But this wouldn't have been the first time that this work has been applied. I mean, I've worked in Mexico and I've worked in various different places in Asia as well and in Europe. So this process and approach has been applied multiple times. And we wanted to, as a group, start focusing on the biological, because that's a really great place to start getting people used to the ideas about how to process and do those step-by-step learning for systemics and understand what are the properties and the underlying steps that you need to do to actually start that process of learning and practice. So we really wanted to focus on the communication. So that's why we did a platform, and so we could all come together and do different types of projects. So it just started as a project-based learning process space, and that's what we wanted to do, and really focus on field work and prepare people for different types of field work. So just going back to the picture that David showed very kindly, this actually kind of was a picture that was done in one of the big workshops that we did there in Shanghai. But the first one we did was actually for 250 people, which turned up spontaneously. We just sent out a call, and this is a different project, this one, but the one, it's very similar setup. And those drums that you can see are were all made on Taobao. So what you do is, in Taobao, you can give them a sort of a design, and they give you all the components, and then we sort of made a workshop of making the drums, and then, you know, you do that, and then you actually also then use them. So CSRP owns all those drums. We processed and actually brought all those together. And as you can see, some of the drumsticks are actually plastic colored ones, and then some are, you know, actual professional drums. The idea was that we had a World Music School pop-up, and the idea about this pop-up learning, but that's all very fun and interesting. But what actually happened during the one with the 250 drummers, you can't actually do that just spontaneously in a park or an open space. You need, it's against regulation. So what you need to do is you have to go to a private space. So we were given a space in a primary school, and they gave us their huge, massive auditorium where we could actually do this, 250 people turning up and doing this. And every kind of age group was there. And so it was quite a lot of fun. But we had some very interesting series of photographs. And then this work then went on to inform some creative systemic processes, so things that are happening in action. So we watched and took photographs of the way in which some of the key drummers would lead the crowd, and then the crowd themselves would form different types of learning circles within the crowd. We actually photographed those things. So that was kind of interesting and exciting for us, and because we were watching it in formation. So that was one of these sort of processes, if you like, that you could see in action. And that was an action-based learning. So that's one of the ways that we did that kind of thing. So we did many different experiments like that. So we wanted to understand a way to create a really tangible sort of transferring of knowledge, information, data, information, knowledge, and then the wisdom. But doing this in different types of context, cultural contexts, is fascinating. It's been a truly fascinating 6 years, I must say. It is anyway, but it is always interesting when you actually have different elements about how to process this, how to introduce it, how to communicate that. And some of the things that we've come across is that there are fundamental key elements which are universal. You could do an analogy, for example, if you took all the shamans of the world and sort of different types of healing processes, there is an underlying approach to spiritual truth that would come across in all different sections of the world. It's the same with in terms of transferring knowledge and communication when you have a sphere which is set, and that's kind of like the idea with the platform. So to get people to understand how to process and learn and communicate. So there's a lot of what's the intent, how you set that up, that's pretty critical. So we've also been experimenting. When I say experimenting, I'm talking about like discussion, testing out those kinds of things, either through discussion, through written, through classwork, through workshop, that sort of thing. The idea that it's systems and design, because there's been discussions in our group about kind of separating the two. And Petra's not online tonight because it's kind of not a very good sociable time to be online in Europe. But she's a really talented a doctor in arts, fine arts, and she has been instrumental actually in developing what we learnt in those drum sort of expressions during 2017. And then when we did the design week for Tonji Design Week in 2019, because it seems like we all lost that last year. I keep wanting to say last year, but it's not. It's 2019. When we did the design week, we actually had a dance routine where one of our colleagues designed a mask dance about civilization and how you communicate through five different masks and how those masks reacted and how they expressed different aspects of a communication. So that was actually based on systemic thinking. So that was quite beautiful. So when we're looking at different types of communications and directions and working with systems and design, these are two, we've been treating them quite separately. We've also had discussions about the fact that there's the idea that Herbert Simon has the famous saying that often cited, everyone designs who, you know, devises courses of actions aimed at changing existing situations into preferred ones. I'm focusing on design right now, but that's not actually wholly and solely. We are actually systemic focused, and it's non-human centric. So this has also taken us off into a very interesting discourse, because being non-human centric, that means that systemic thinking actually lends itself very well. And where does that leave with systemic design? And so that's a very interesting question, which I would like to, I've got a little question at the end of all of this, which I'd like to pose. This has been a sort of a discussion in a direction, because we're in a school of design and innovation. However, that's not, my background is also much more complex adaptive systems. But I've kind of looked at both of those as actually really relevant to one another and how they impact each other. So, you know, the judgment, the intuition, the experience, the social interaction, when you look at Simon's logic of design and how that actually impacts systemic thinking is quite interesting. This is also what we've been looking at as a group. Design research and practice. So these are things that I think are still emerging. And so we're kind of witnessing some interesting kind of, evolution and emergence. And this is also happening with our colleagues. Some of them would know Thomas Marlowe in the States. He's at Seton College. And we've written some works together over the years. And one of the more recent ones is looking at how this could be defining some different ways of how watching how different disciplines emerge out of one another. So that's another sort of discourse and direction that we've been discussing. But looking at the science of design and also sciences of the artificial and how those are actually playing with each other. So they're also some of the questions that we've been looking at. And this is just the discourse side of it. But taking it now, 2019, 2020, and then managing at the end of last year to bring in more people to that conversation, because of the geographical location, we decided to try to then move it to Switzerland so that we could actually bring back more of the European discourse in a more sort of friendly time zone, actually, which is practical for practical reasons as well. So we wanted to start to look at different and also to kickstart again, because there was a really great tradition in Swiss Italy, actually, that region, that they had many years ago, was it about 10 years ago, there had been regular systemic meetings. So we wanted to bring all of that back. There was an opportunity for us to actually do that, because Yelena, who's going to speak later, is actually a colleague Japan now, and she, I was her supervisor when she was doing her master's at Tonji, a dual one at Tonji with Politecnico Torino, and she achieved cum laude there. And so because she's based in Switzerland, we decided to take the opportunity to incorporate it there. So this means now that it actually is an organization, it's a platform, and it's been serving quite a number of people who need more sort of contact processes. We need to be more collaborative. And so we're sort of more residential. So we've been sort of inviting and doing a lot of internships, regardless of what level you could be, undergraduate, master's. That's the kind of process that we've been taking. We found that really beneficial because you really create a sort of a more of a family atmosphere, and you can bring people together for longer term, which suits us because a lot of the things we have been looking at, because of those things I just mentioned briefly, are more interesting when you actually want to look at them from a longitudinal point of view. So a lot of the feedback that I have been getting in terms of projects is that it's difficult if you really want to do things longer term. We're seemingly losing a lot of the continuity because of the different ways in which universities are set up and how education processes are happening right now. This is an interesting question anyway, not just now, but for the future. What are universities going to evolve into? What are the process? This has actually shown up a whole different aspect of how we've been teaching, learning, engaging, communicating, all of these. So during this time, I had several different interns, and we had a residential internship here in Finland last year. That worked out quite well. It was quite difficult under the circumstances, but we had students there. Obviously, they were on a farm outside of Helsinki. So we've been looking at the rural, peri-urban, and all those relationships between those. And also, that's part of the reason why we wanted to set up Switzerland, so that we could do it much more sort of a residential process. The people in Shanghai that we all know each other, they've all been residential, more or less residential, living in Shanghai and coming to college, yes, but they actually have had to move and live in different location in another country. So they need a lot of support. So and we found that those, and we had another colleague who was actually residential in Barcelona during last year as well, at a PhD level. So it's been a very interesting process to collaborate in many different locations, but have people sort of nested in residential situations whilst they're doing their work. It has provided far more stability and the possibility of being able to do things in a much more consistent and longitudinal manner. Obviously, universities aren't always set up to do it in this way, but that's part of the reason why we set up CSRP Institute, because we want to develop this kind of collaboration and sort of see where it goes in terms of how that can actually progress in their future. So that's kind of a very important aspect. One of the really good examples of what we've been doing is we had a project called the Beijiao Project. Beijiao is a small town of several million, maybe 5 million or 6 million or so, outside of Guangzhou. I know people don't think that's a small town, but it is for China. And Guangzhou is a major, a mega city in the south. And it's what they call the Bay Area. And this project was something we won funding for. And it was very unusual for us to win funding for that because it was for local government. And it had, overall, we had about, at last count, about 250 different people coming, going, students, international, local, government, many different people engaged in that process over just under 2 years. Yihan is online, and I did want him to sort of, if he wished to, he can talk about it afterwards, or he can mention, if he wants to mention something now. But I would like him to, if when we go into discussion, maybe he can just give his viewpoint on it, because he was a very important collaborator on that part. And Yihan has been instrumental in building up CSRP in Shanghai, and we have been endeavoring also, for example, to do things like the Club of Rome, trying to set up work and projects, and also just meetings. We're doing and working on that all the time, so we've been doing that over the last couple of years as well. So this is actually kind of where I'd like to sort of bring things to a head for now. The paper, finally, I'd like to just mention the paper too, because the paper's, I think David put in the note about the Sochi Miyoko paper, which is just published last year in 2020 in the Cultural Heritage Journal and Sustainable Development. It was some, all the elements in that paper are different aspects of longitudinal experimentation and research and applied and in the field. That work started in 2016, and so the paper was only just published just last year, as I said. It took a long time to sort of collect all the elements of it, and we wanted to sort of really investigate the properties involved. So we were looking at sort of trying to do different models. And I think it's very important that an aspect to do, and I'm sure many other people are doing it as well, but I think that there is room for multiple different people doing the same kind of experimentation and investigation and also practice at looking at the longitudinal, non-human-centric aspect and how those properties impact across the different elements of, say, for example, peri-urban, over transitions. But in the case of this paper, it happened to be peri-urban, rural, and those, that was the focus. You could have picked any range of things, but you have to pick something so that you can communicate that clearly. So we picked the peri-urban aspect of it. So that longitudinal approach and also getting people to model, and I mean by modeling, we understand that's representational, of course, but there is no perfect modeling. So it's really important that we actually get the chance to actually create the understanding of what modeling is and what it is to apply, and to be much more broad and understand that that's just a tool like a communication. This is nothing new to any of you, but in terms of applying it and finding sort of models for people to work together, this is actually going to be a bigger question. How do we do this work together over a long period? So we're wanting to do this kind of sort of, like I said, residential longitudinal aspect of it. And just to add to that, we've now actually got a farm in Spain, in Catalonia, which is southern Catalonia near Tarragona. And we have over 6 hectares there. And so we'll be experimenting different aspects as a community and developing. And so this has been an ongoing process over the last 24 months. We got held up again from last year. But this is going to be the next stage of development and actually being able to produce things in the field over a long period of time and setting up longer-term experimentation and understanding and actually producing things, because we want to actually understand what we're going to do. So going into the discussion, I'll just mention it here and then we can mention it again. I wanted to talk about the idea of determining courses of action. So what is the preferred, whose preferred, you know, situations do we choose? And what kinds of courses of action? We're going to take a course of action, we determine that, but whose preferred situations are we actually aiming for in terms of understanding, designing outcomes? So as a group, looking at systemic through the lens of systemic thinking, so who's, you know, who determines the course of action, and actually whose preferred situations are we aiming for? So, but I'll bring that up again at the end of that. So right now, David, I'd like to quickly ask Yihan to say something, and then we'll go on to Yeli.
Actually, let's take a moment. Peter had actually had a comment. Peter, would you like to unmute and speak a little bit about your idea there?
Well, what are we opening it up just for a couple of questions here?
Just a couple, and then we'll have Yihan start up.
Okay. Well, I wanted to go back to what you were saying about the different schools of thought in the interface design systemics. And there really are, you know, there's when we really look at all the different schools that we come from, when, and this is kind of the, as you know, the origination or the source for why we have relating systems thinking and design, that there are so many different relational aspects. We've created really a system of integration, inclusion, and for cross-disciplinary understanding between all these different schools of thought. And I think what is the way I see it, this isn't exactly what I put in the chat, but the way I see it is that both design disciplines and schools of systems thinking are both quite integrative and inclusive on their own. I mean, we have our own perspectives and disciplines that we lead from, but we're not exclusionary in these fields. So when you're bringing these together, there are some unique perspectives. So but taking those disciplines out of the way and instead looking at how practice works in these different places. So you're describing the rural, urban, and we could consider that, you know, small town, bioregional. In a lot of the work that we're doing in new economies right now, we're looking at an ecological economics approach, kind of overall, to identifying emerging new economic forms that might serve as exemplars for future next economies that could evolve into approaches that we could, you know, then work with from a systemic design perspective, as, you know, as conserving the different, you know, values of that location. And so the bioregion is really, you know, the socio-ecological perspective in the bioregion is a really it's really a site of flourishing that we're seeing in a lot of places around the world. And I think that might be appropriate to the site that you were mentioning. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at you know, who the stakeholders are, who we engage in design in those perspectives, in a bioregion, it isn't just, of course, then the humans. I mean, so in an ecological system, you know, the ecology itself is an emergence of all the different participants. And so we're, one of the ways we need to look at an economy in that perspective as well is that it's integrated with the bioregion. The natural setting is also a stakeholder, and we need ways to engage the different natural participants, wildlife, fauna, the flora and fauna, rivers and water systems, and have a mix of indigenous and economic perspectives in some ways, or indigenous to that location. And so this is one of the emerging perspectives that's become very rich in the last year, and I think has also, you know, taken hold in quite a few of the research studies that we're seeing in RSD, you know, coming out of Torino, among the Italian perspective, primarily as well. But also in dialogue and social systems is similar, but in a different way, that we're, the designers are the stakeholders themselves and not us as a design team. And so maybe there's a sense of that in the emergence and the formation of, you know, hundreds of people participating in, you know, in a pickup kind of music workshop as well. So let me get your sense of these different, you know, sites and regions. And we really, you know, are we paying attention to who are the designers in these different contexts?
I think in this instance, thank you, Peter. That's really interesting. For the music aspect of it, that was like a learning tool. I'm just describing it that way, just simply, because it was a way in which we could do like something emergent in the middle of a mega city of 26 million. You know, how do you do? There's no environment to speak of in that way. But just understanding the elements, the properties that you're supposed to be looking out for. Can you see them? Do they make sense? Can you identify them? That kind of thing. So that was that aspect of it. But I get what you're saying. There's that. But also the longitudinal aspect is why I kind of emphasize that. Because in the environmental aspect, which is so rich, as you said, so many different aspects, it has so many facets there. We like to look at it from the longitudinal, but I want to emphasize that Peter, David knows about this, the provenance. So it's like the historical provenance, the, evolutional provenance. So this can be applied to the humans, the ecology, the landscape, also the cultural heritage of that space. But that's kind of, it's not just cultural heritage, it's also the evolution of that heritage, and all those different spectrums that involves and also informs that. So I think the elements of what we've been looking at over the last 4 years especially is the longitudinal, the provenance, and that when you look at the systemic approach to this, the knowledge networking, the communication, it's not just communication about people. So it's communication about many different aspects on all levels. So that's kind of explaining very nicely about what we're focused on and what we have been focused on and what we're still going to aim to do. So in terms of the design, they are actually design, and they are meaning individuals and also collective and sort of the concept in that sort of umbrella. Design in that element is actually an element of it. It's informing, it's part of the process and the provenance, and if you're engaging in that, but predominantly it has to be something that actually fits in with your view or what you're focused on at that time. And of course, what you're focused on means that also excludes what you're missing, you know, so if you're focused on something that precludes what you're not seeing. So in terms of understanding how to approach it in a holistic manner, that's probably something that also requires attention and focus. You know, so that it sounds crazy to sort of say focus on something so that you can see it holistically. I mean, but the understanding that being aware of holistic approach is probably a better way rather than saying focused on. But so you're taking all of those elements into your purview so that you can understand and hopefully as a collective produce more than what you could do individually, because it's just not possible to do it as an individual kind of approach. Yeah. So how to learn to play like an orchestral member in an orchestra so that you can get the main piece of music out, which happens to be interpreting a landscape or comprehending an ecosystem or whatever it is that you're focused on. So that's kind of the analogy I can kind of come up with there. But thank you. It was thoughtful. Thanks for your comment.
Mm-hmm. Susu, could you introduce Yihan?
Yihan, are you there? Have you got your speaker on? Can we hear you?
Oh, yes. Hi.
Yihan, Hello, this is my colleague Yihan, Professor Yihan Chen. He is from Tongji, and he's actually in Shanghai. So it's only 7:30 in the morning or something reasonable like that, isn't it? So I would just want to say that Yihan is a very good colleague. He also has worked with David. The three of us have worked in a bit of a trio there in Shanghai. And Yihan, I'd love you to be able to comment a little bit on the Beijar project and your key views and how you saw that unfold and evolve. And what are the main kinds of lessons that we had to learn, and also not just that, just some of the things we had to overcome and how to actually make that process happen, you know, and how unique it really was, because you could never do it again in the current circumstances.
Okay, that's a big job for me. Basically, I'm still rethinking all the process all the time. Beijar was an experience, and also for me, it's I'm trained as an engineer, chemical engineer, and through SUSU, I came to know about the social innovation, systemic thinking, etc., etc. Although for engineer, systemic thinking was born in our blood. So, well, there are systemic errors, et cetera, et cetera. So for Beijing, let's take that example, because I'm a chemist. We do experiments. So we always try to use the experiment to see what happening and what can we learn from that. Beijar is very interesting, as what Susu mentioned. I think that is maybe the only one from governmental funds funding a foreign professor doing a local project. I can't be sure that after Susu where there'll be anyone, but before, I think that there's no one. So basically, it's not possible. Why? It's too much down to the earth and looking for the needs of the people. And this is what Chinese doesn't want, the foreigner to have a hand on that. So let's look at what Tibet happening or wherever the other places. It's not only the Tibet against foreigner. Tibet is even against any outsiders. You know, this is actually I learned later on when I have currently I'm having another project in Dandong, Damba, and that place actually between Tibet and Sichuan, and there you can see that actually any people coming to that area is treated as a foreigner, or let's say it's an outsider. Okay, so it's not so easy. We had 2 years. We need a lot of time to convince not the mayor. If that happened that the mayor believed that will help the people, that's why we are engaged. Otherwise, we have no chance. The mayor did a training in the university and got a doctor degree, etc., so that he knows that there are something different ways to do such research or work from bottom up. And what's happening all the time in China is top down. Mm-hmm. And that 2 years, we have actually gone through all levels from bottom. And I learned a lot, because I never thought Chinese would talk or speak from their mind, and that happens. That's I have to say that Susu's methodology do bring the people talking in different levels, and that's not easy. But I would say, in a certain sense, we are only in the beginning. So after 2 years, we actually have that first step. And with that first step, we have found out some emergence. And with that emergence, actually, the government should, or we should have a second step and try to implement something, and et cetera, et cetera. But the party leader or secretary call a stop. No, whatever reasons you might guess. Anyway, that was actually the beginning of this triangle, which Susu mentioned, of the Bay Area, which, and again, the Bay Area is a top-down approach. It's very, which maybe Peter's comments is also Tongji school. That means that we create a space and fill in things. And that is happening now in the Bay Area. And also, I'm facing also some other projects close to Shanghai, between you know, the rural area and the main city. So that area, we just get the place and the construction or buildings are ready. Now, how what supposed to come in? Can create economy, which yes, Peter also mentioned, eco-economy, etc. So and somehow has to find a way to harmonize with the environment and the new residents, because all the residents are moved away. So this is actually happening. Beijing is an extra and a different way and different approach. And I have to say that, well, it's a pity that we couldn't continue.
That's yes, and I hope, thank you very much. And I hope we can write that up very soon together. I think it's okay to do that. But I'll just quickly mention here and then I'll hand over to Yelena. But we did actually do a really lovely project out of it. One of the things that came out of it was the project called A Sense of Belonging, which was one of the key elements that came out of it. But we made a 25-minute film, which the student, we still want to actually do something with. And that was extremely challenging, and we managed to do it and show it to 50 members of the government who authorized it and approved at that time. So we wouldn't mind actually polishing that up, you know, that film, and doing it would be a really nice foundation for a lovely documentary. It's pretty interesting. So we should do that one day, Yuhen, and sort that out. So that's one of my next steps I'd like to do. So thank you so much. I didn't sort of prepare you, but thanks, you did very well. Thank you for jumping in. It's so nice to have you, and it's good to see you, actually. So David, should we go to Yelena?
Well, just pause for Yelena. A question.
Okay.
Gary has a question, so let's have him have that.
Just real quick, since that you're talking about the efforts toward mass work, mass experimentation, right? Getting lots and lots of experiments going in different places. And what I'm curious about, though, is the issue of scale. Because, so just take the agricultural example. You talked about six hectares in Spain. The kind of work that a small group of people would do on six hectares is kind of wide open, right? They could do a lot of small scale things and pretty much whatever they chose to do. If you were going to think about doing an agricultural experiment or an innovation of some kind, and you were thinking about a really massive institutional farm, then even what you would be trying, because of the factors that are in place and the possible limiting factors, might be really different. You know, if you're going to try regenerating organisms in the soil, you know, small scale, not so hard. You know, industrial farm, whole different issue. So I'm just curious, when you think about the design and the people involved in the design and sort of the implications, how do you think about the work you're approaching, especially in China, where 5 million is a small town?
Yeah, well, that's a really great question. I mean, that project was already like 250, and that was nothing. That was immediately, like, it just came to that number. I mean, it wasn't hard to make numbers. I mean, it just, it just flowed that way. So every class you have, there's always 20 involved. Then you have a class, another class is like, so you get up to 100 or 200 pretty quickly. And I don't think that 250, we put that number in, but I actually think it was way more than that. They're the ones that we could solidly identify in terms of the process. Because we used like networks, and I could do a whole thing on this actually, which a whole presentation just on this, but just quickly, what we did do, it was cyclical. We used a cyclical process over 6 month cycles. Mm-hmm. And so each cycle was documented. So yes, we actually built that up quite quickly. And it needed to be done rapidly because China's things happen fast. That's typical. And it's scale. So speed and scale. And if you're trying to build up bottom up, you have to move fast because the kind of thinking and the process and the environment you're working is very top down. So you move fast in order to do what you can to build up the next cycle. So you do it, it's all cyclical. So we built it all on cycles. Iteration is nothing new. But in terms of how you bring everybody along and how you empower everybody, it's actually really important to build a very good kind of community. And that sort of process, that methodology, there's a whole lot of elements to that that you can sort of say, well, you know, no, none of that's new. But application and training people to take up things who've never done that before, that is actually quite difficult. So that's not easy. And as Yihan said, it's unusual that any sort of outsider would do that. So you have to work in a particular way to make sure that you're not an outsider and get the right people to do that so that the outsiders aren't doing that. And there's a lot of processes that go. So you've got processes embedded inside the cycles embedded. So it's like systems within cycles within cycles. So and you need to map that along the way. So, but it needs to be, you need to pay attention to the emergence all the time. So you're not, you can't sort of say, well, we're going to plan this and this is what we're doing. It doesn't work that way. You got to really have faith in the emergence and actually follow that process and actually be true to it. If it takes you in a different direction, that's the emergence of it. So you need to sort of say, well, okay, these are the things that these processes and elements, and this is how it emerged. Was that our intention? Multiple times, actually, it was good that you allowed people involved to let that emerge. And they were super pleased when they actually were responsible for that. So you let them do that. That's really important. So it really is a skill set that this is also part of what we're trying to do, this skill set of actually getting people to comprehend how to drive, not drive, but lead from behind the bottom-up process. Yeah, so you have to have faith. It's not easy. It's the first thing I'll say. It's not easy. But it was really great. I just say it was exciting. Yeah, in a sort of a terrifying way. No, I'm kidding. It was great. So, yeah, thanks for the question. So, David, should we go to Yelena?
Yes, let's do that.
Yelly, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You can introduce yourself.
Okay. So I'm Yelena Sucic, and as already a bit introduced by Susu, I was her little student once. Now we are colleagues trying to do stuff together. And I have a background in systemic design from Polytechnic of Torino. And I did this double master degree in Tongji University in service systems design. And now I'm actually doing a post-master in climate change adaptation and mitigation solutions. So I'm upgrading things in terms of scales. And my role here is a bit to give an insight of a biological based work that I did with Susu in China. And as David has introduced with the paper reference, Introduction to the Value of Living Systems Beyond the Price, it's a research that had started by questioning what can we do to face global big issues like climate change, biodiversity losses, and so on. And I tried also to design something practically in big scale, so trying to get in touch with governments and politicians, but was basically untouchable in terms of applications, because then the timing gets much more longer, much more people have to get involved. And so I had to completely change perspective and go back on individuals. What can we do as individuals to contribute in this bigger scale problems resolutions? And what helped me in this was my background also in permaculture. I did the permaculture training, and by inverting this perspective, I had also to find this under resolution for addressing climate change. I actually use a lot of climate change in my research as effect scaling of things, where this little thing can actually go on. And so what was my main problem here was to find back the focus, our relationship on what our lives depend on, because we know that those global issues are going to affect our lives. And this had to be something that we could relate on, observe, use, interact with at our individual level. And I reached out with plants. Plants are primary producers. They provide us oxygen. We live thanks to them. We breathe thanks to them. We eat thanks to them. They even provide us clean water, medicine, all serial kind of things. And what's very practical of them, they stay in that point. So in terms of systems, it really helps to have a focus, go back, go wide, and then focus back on. And especially because plants are so fixed, but at the same time in strict relation with the atmosphere, the hydrosphere, and the lithosphere. And from there, we can start to see all series of phenomena like soil fertilization, the decomposition processes, if you get in the relationship with the fertilization for the plant and the other organisms involved with it, and the air system, so the air cleaning system, because plants take off the carbon dioxide and then they emit oxygen, which is useful for us and all animals. But then this find that's also a problem. Okay, we know these things, but we lost the relationship with them. We don't really do things. We don't interact with what the plant interactions are. So we kind of got trapped in this, environmental systems like economy, society, and culture, which actually depend on the natural system. So what are the other ecosystems and living creature systems? And this forgetting all depends on, and this forgetting is enhanced, and we can see it especially in the urban context, and especially in youth, that right now are at least the third generation completely detached from nature. And this detachment risks to make us lose the knowledge in being able to keep going or adapt, provide for ourselves in case of crisis. Because in nature we can provide ourselves, we can't all access to the technology to build things, to produce our own things, to synthesize or to go on. So if we lose this knowledge in the generation, who will provide for us? How we can manage to recover this knowledge if we never had that practice relation, an association of experience in seeing this, and so be able to reconstruct the mechanism and the relationship with the system. But also as individual, if you think about that, how can we define ourselves sustainable if we are not able to sustain ourselves from nature? We don't have that kind of knowledge with us. So in very shrinking scale, we can then refine the relationships in upgrading the scales on and understanding more systems, changing the focuses and so on. And this gives also a focus of finding where have also technology developed, like networks and things on. Now all, you find the same things in nature as well. And what this focus brought then made us use this focus, this focus as a tool of experimentation with different ranges of youth, like high school students and university students, in knowledge recognition experiments, but also in practical, in trying to apply things by recovering a knowledge that they didn't consider until before in a practical way. So trying to put in practice this knowledge, which is commonly known, it should be known by everybody, but in the same time is not tangible anymore. It's kind of fading in a common structure. And this meets, that brought also to build the thesis project and develop so the dynamics of potential sustainable technologies between citizens and plants. So there was a lot of this focus of in the urban context that is, because we have all this push also for immigration, things in urbanizing, or going towards the technology, which risks to create an unbalanced situation where we want to be able to readapt and recover or figure out other things to apply. And this is also something that, especially in terms of design process, we can see it already in the phenomenon of seeing if human-centered design is really, where is actually the center of this human-centered design? Because we, in the end, we all look for our needs, we produce for our needs, we produce, we will develop something that will create some behaviors and will reach the aimed behaviors of it, but also other effects. So the effect of dissatisfaction, but also other effects, like for example, we are facing now the air pollution, which is causing, between many other things, a block of radiations. And so it doesn't allow us to balance the temperature, and so we are having climate change issues. And so basically what happens is that the center is not anymore really in our need, but this cause, it's in the effect, which is causing problems, which become our needs again. And so we have to, again, find a goal of work on these things, which actually could have been prevented, at least partially, so not becoming such huge problems, accumulated effects and problems that will become a need to be solved and so respond to our necessities. And so how do we try to maintain these applications is through common shared applied knowledge. And in order to do that, we need communities that try to apply this, have a sharing, exchange, and especially in terms of different regions, because according to context, also the applications that have been kept are different because the emergence of applications derived from different things. But at the same time, this shows the need of new educational paradigms and tools to reintroduce layers of reading that are not just as a word reading or an image, but also applying sounds different interactions, relating with people, energy, different layers, which help us to keep this knowledge and apply it in the future or transmit it to our future generations and so on. Okay, I had a little, you want more?
we actually have some questions, Yelena. Okay. So we have Gary first and then Peter.
Maybe that it doesn't, okay.
Gary?
Yeah, I was actually just making a quick comment, David, but the idea of the knowledge. So I'm actually curious, Yelena, in as you're talking about the things that may be forgotten. You know, it sounds like you're getting to a point that maybe there are really foundational bases of knowledge we need in order for the design to be able to happen. I mean, we can't design from what we've forgotten unless there's some, you know, other knowledge base to draw from. And so as you think about the work you're doing, say, for instance, with climate change, which is enormous, are there really foundational bases of knowledge that you see as being critical to getting started before you can even really begin that work in a serious way?
Yeah, exactly this. They're realizing where things come from. If you think about what could imagine now, for example, the Chinese kids I had, they don't think they don't even realize that things can transform, like for example, for soil. I had this thing that they couldn't even imagine. They were amazed seeing the soil changing, the dirt, so the wet waste that becomes soil. And so if you don't realize that things can return and where they come from, you can't even try to create another relationship later. So if the elements which you start from, you can't realize that they can keep going already from when you start. So it's already a design decision that you try to deal with elements that are already meant to reintegrate in a cycle. Or you design already the cycles that they will reintegrate these elements. It's the aspect of being conscious that there is this cycle that has to keep going. And nature has demonstrated this always. That's the way it works. And that's how we can also see that like concept of zero waste are possible, because in the natural system, everything re-enter somewhere. Meanwhile, in our advanced applications, for example, in, well, if we take out like batteries for power, solar panel powering and things like that, then the disposal of it, this disposal, we are not still able to reintegrate, or the times of reintegration are all much more beyond of what we can do with those material that we have invested, so that become unfunctional. So it's trying to set a mindset that what you start, you have to try to already give options for where it can continue. Because if not, we will have the effect of being a pollution thing, which is something that's useless to the system. It can't re-enter in the cycle. And this plant example, so the relationship the plant does, helps to find these associations with other circumstances. So it can scale in different contexts. The elements are always the same. The tendency of the behaviors are the same, but behaviors are the same, elements change in the context, and but produce the same phenomena. So, it's a kind of trying to, and in this thing, you can also have this creativity that can emerge because you can realize that this can behave the same way if you create these conditions within that context. Maybe I extended too much.
Good, thank you.
You're welcome.
Peter?
Yeah, I put one question in the chat, but I think I just ask a really much broader question, just to hear your thoughts about how, especially over longer term periods, how are design relationships sustained? And how are design interventions lead to change? And I don't mean to scale, but do you have a theory of change for their impact? And is there an ethical orientation to the way that, you know, that you would work in design? Because we're always localized. So how, you know, what types of changes would our localized interventions lead to in the kind of context you're talking about?
As I already mentioned before, if we have different contexts that already have a knowledge and they collect this knowledge, and if we have sharing platform, which makes you realize that the same kind of, say, technology that it's applied in that region for that same purpose, can be applied also in another context. So there is a specific technology setting of things that allows you to do a certain thing, which is much more efficient and sustainable and all those things.
Let's say that's for transition or something. Yeah.
You have a transition and there is this exchange. Mm. And also maybe you see a part of it which can relate to what you already have, and then you can make evolve your thing. So there is not only a transition between space, but also within the time of itself. Mm. That's what the association of having these exchanges allow to bring forward in terms of application and design.
Okay.
Susu?
Yes. What would you like me to do now, David?
I think you could summarize a bit, and then we'll see if we get people catching up on questions and more discussion. I think that we'll probably do. It is late where you are, so I don't want to run too long.
Yeah, it's pressing on to 2:30 a.m. But that's okay. Yeah. It's fine. I'm happy to do it. Just to summarize, I think that thanks for all the questions. They were really good. I think it's come out. It's been clear that where we're going with where we want to do what the sort of platform that we're creating. I think to summarize, I think that we're heading. Yelena's comments about the final ones about what kind of education, skill sets, processes do we need to be looking at? This is a rhetorical. I'm just simply saying that this is something that we're having to look at now. We're going to need new ways of actually, or they're emerging already, different ways of how to do training and just how do we engage with education and doing it in a sort of a more longitudinal manner, because the issues that we're looking at aren't something that you can just solve in pieces. It's connected. So the education should be reflecting that as well. I mean, you just simply can't do it in pieces. It is okay to do some of the training and some of the elements so that you can maybe get your teeth into the ideas, but what I found over the last, since, what is it, when was I in Aalto, since 2012, it seems to be that you really have to design or approach or engage and communicate in some sort of cycles that make sense in terms of continuity. And whilst we talk about that, I feel that the processes that have been in educational institutions are sort of fragmented somewhat. And also now we've had last year, which has been unprecedented, but that just seemed to make it more obvious that the fragmentation is there and the fragility of keeping continuity. So the understanding the history, the longitudinal, how do you do that? When you don't have the mechanisms in place to sustain that. So these are what we've been trying to, this is what we're interested in doing in the platform, you know. So we're not saying that we have all the, you know, answers or questions even, but this is what we're attempting to do. So thanks for listening. Thanks for inviting us, David. So should we hang around or should we run away? It's up to you.
I'm going to let Stephen, who's always eager, have a question. Stephen?
Yeah, thanks for your presence. I was just curious about maybe how learning clusters, whether there's like the idea of learning clusters amongst the sort of professors and postdocs that you sort of see a lot in applied psychology departments, where they have that advantage that they're not stuck into the cycles of undergrad, you know, where you kind of have to cycle through, that they can be focused on maybe an area, whether that's somewhere where the knowledge can be still slightly alive and updated, but also longitudinal. Because it sounds like you're kind of straddling research and inquiry-based approaches. You want to keep it so that it's still, it's not been like put in the textbook, so to speak. Mm. But, you know, it's also got to have some research chops, so to speak.
Yeah, I like that. There's a couple of things that have informed the approaches. Looking at industry and looking at industry clusters, that's actually some of the work that's happened over the last, if I go beyond 10 years into more like 15 years, looking at that. So actually some of the elements actually grew from industry clusters, and those clusters were 20 years long. So, you know, there's lots of rich information that you can gain from those kinds of things. And how those formulations come together, you can never reproduce them. Governments would love to be able to reproduce an industry cluster, for example, but that's a place where it's quite rich and you've got a lot of crossover and you've got a lot of research and practice happening. So those elements are really wonderful to sort of lean on and, you know, absorb and, you know, try to get some informed experience from. The other one that just off the top of my head, which actually has had impact with us as well, because of the creative systemic aspect of it, because creating is many different, it's got many modalities involved. One of them was looking at the sort of the London Shakespeare Company, when one of the directors there started, and going back to the idea of ensembles, which is just very similar to what you've just described, actually, music ensembles, where they are a cluster, actually, a smaller cluster within a bigger organization. And it's very dynamic. And there are people come and go, but the ensemble pretty much stays as a community of practice. So you've got your, you know, and so now I'm going into knowledge management, I know, but it is actually runs a parallel a lot of the times and crosses over. So you've got your community of interest and you've got your community of experts and the community of practice where they all get together and practice. And then somebody got a new idea and they have a bit of an offshoot and off they go. But this is actually something that it's lovely. Until you try to put it into practice, you really have to have a little bit of a skill set to get that going and keep it, sort of keeping an eye on things to just nurture it. And then it takes off and everyone gets the hang of it, you know, and then it's okay. But I like your comment. It's absolutely true. And so it's not to say that we can't have those. Why not? We could. There's nothing really to stop us except for regulations, all sorts, a range of things. So kind of, I guess what our group kind of came together because we want to try something different. I mean, that's the basis of it, really. Thanks for your question.
Yeah, no, thanks. That's very interesting. I'll look up those industry clusters. That's good to know about because I'd like to see what they're trying to do with that?
There's quite a number of papers, but one of the ones I was referring to was in Melbourne. It's a 20-year long one. It's defense engineering, but nevertheless, it's operating exactly the same way. That defense project was 20 years long, and it actually created a huge raft of small medium enterprise. And the small to medium enterprise behaved like Lego blocks, and they were the foundation building blocks for an entire industry that built up around that. It's like the Southern Australian sort of Victorian equivalent of Silicon Valley kind of thing, you know.
Very similar. Yeah, like in Toronto, Stephen, you should, yeah, I mean, the Mars is starting a climate change cluster. So, I mean, because they already have a clean tech startup, groups, and that's drawn in. They've been attempting to build, you know, a clean tech community. And so they've expanded that to climate change, which then reaches out to a broader range of more social and technological solutions. So it's not exactly an industry, you know, building large industries yet, but they are funding it, and it is local. Ooh. I had a question, Susu, about publishing and sharing, and how are you exploring new ways of communicating, like in
form? Oh, publishing, I've got some real, that's a real interesting thing. Publishing, I'm actually looking to mirror exactly the same kinds of things that I've been talking about tonight. It's kind of a thing that I'd really like to do, because I just feel that publishing is not serving. It really isn't serving our community, our academic community. And I'm super like wanting to try different things and really break out and do some stuff. We've talked about this, Peter, and I know you and I have some very interesting ideas, both of us, but I'm seeing it more and more, and I just feel as though the people, we give our time, we give our energy, we get the research grants, we do the work, and yet we give it all away for somebody to monetize. And I'm finding that less and less productive in terms of what we actually as a planet and as species really need right now. So I'm feeling quite like about that right now. So that's one of my touchstones, because I just don't think it's serving. It's not serving us, and it's not serving our future generations. And I just don't want to ignore it anymore. So if people ask me right now, I'll just say, nope, I don't agree with what's going on in terms of publishing. I think it's predatory beyond belief, and it's someone has to draw a line in the sand somewhere to say enough is enough. It's too much, and it's ruining us, all of us. It's too predatory. So
it's
that's that
reinforcing kind of mutually reinforcing self-serving cycle in academic.
Totally,
culture, isn't it?
You want to type four.
Who's your audience?
Exactly. So you want to type four, cycle that says, getting it right for the wrong reasons. I mean, I'm over it. I'm done. So, I really want to see us going in completely different directions, because this community, if not this community, who, apart from cybernetics and other people, informatics, systematics, those kinds of people, we have to have a way of doing things differently. Yiheng probably can talk to, he's had interesting publishing, they've done that in the Club of Rome, some different models. But we really need to sort of break out and do something. And honestly, apart from your paycheck and sort of worrying about that, why are we doing this? I get asked this question, and what do you say? I mean, oh, well, because it was my job. I mean, sort of like, it's not good enough. I don't think it's a good enough answer anymore. So it's probably not very popular if you want to sort of build a career and all of those sorts of things. But if we think about journals were letters to our colleagues, to one another, to talk about things that we were working on. That's what it was about. it wasn't about anybody else. And it was two colleagues in your group or your area so that they understood what you were talking about, not to somebody else who had no clue what you were talking about and didn't understand the nuances, so perhaps would not be sympathetic while the idea is still building, you know, this comprehension of, you know, let's take everybody down because, you know, I know more. This, the academic curiosity and academic criticism and critique is very important, but academic thuggery, that's quite another thing. So we need to sort of kind of get away from that, you know. It's not nice, Peter, it's not nice. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. I want to ask people when they want to approach these things is, what's the intent? What's your intention? If the intention is to support people and to promote understanding and communication, it's great. And if you ask tough questions, there's no problem with that. That's okay. But what's your intent? You know, that's it really. But you're right. I mean, that goes hand in hand with the process, and we're trying to do some different things. I don't know if we'll succeed, possibly not, but I don't mind trying. So,
no, that's good. That. We do need to attempt our own experiments and to learn from them to see what's, you know, what's forming in,
I think so,
in the realm of our communications, of scholarly communications, which is, well, between peers, as you said, so tradition of scholarly letters. But more and more I'm finding with the types of articles that are things that we're writing in systemic design, that the systemic design community, I don't want it to start becoming insulated or its own discipline where we're talking to each other.
That's the problem too.
If we write in other journals, so in policy and environment and organizational studies, in system science as well, which doesn't really understand what we're doing that the other disciplines that we touch on or we're impacting or other contexts could learn a lot from what we're writing. So it seems like even we are playing it safe by sharing with our friends, in a sense, by our peers and colleagues that we know, understand, and respect, and use and cite the work that we're doing. But could we, like, step out and really start to, you know, communicate more to really the journals and the public communications, the trade magazines, even of the stakeholders whose lives we're shaping, whose worlds that we're working in.
I think it's a good comment, and honestly, I to put my money where my mouth is, so to speak, I do publish in many different types of journals and have done and written conference papers and all sorts of chapters and what have you, and it is not easy. I mean, the Xochitl Mielpo paper, for example, hit several brick walls because we published in the one that sits in, but even in sustainability journals, and you hit people who are engineers, and I'm not saying anything to you, Ian. I come from a school of engineer. They are totally unsympathetic. But the problem is you've got then editorial who don't know how to have the conversation between an author and a reviewer who may be at loggerheads for good reasons, but its editorial position has to take in and take charge. Then you find out that people, it's monetary, so that the person in charge of who's an editor hasn't got a PhD and they can't enter into the conversation. These are the kinds of things that are happening. So, you know, how do you, you know, the regulation, this is the thing. It's a little bit of the Wild West. We don't know the full impact. So part of understanding, there's a flip side. One side, you want to know the journal that you're working with because you know that the people who are doing will do the job. On the other hand, if you try a different journal and then you find out that, wow, it's set up in a way that's perhaps not so good, These are the things you'll find out the hard way. And you know how long it is to go through the cycle of, you know, submission, blah, 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 you know, go through all of that. It's time. So you can have this. This is a really important, and I believe that your comment is true. In terms of design, we need to break out and have different, you know, and I'm always pushing that. This is also part of the reason why it's a platform. I mean, that's the reason. That was absolutely one of the core things. And David will and Yehem were both there when we tried to set up a communication platform, which we haven't given up on yet, but to do an exchange, so electronic letters, in fact, or something like that. We'll still, you know, we may get that going again, but we tried to set that up as a communication so that sort of like something that you can get together as a project and work together for a period of time. But these are all ideas that I'd like to sort of experiment with at some point. Thanks for the question.
Thank you, David. Susu, mm-hmm. and Yihang, and also Yelena, for your time and for the hours. This is fully international. This is why we should actually work regional. This is the maximum System Thinking Ontario stretch that we've done. For people who are interested in next month's topic, Zad will be leading a conversation with Peter Tuddenham on systems literacy. And so a lot of the questions I think that came up today may resurface next month. For people that need connection to Susu, he's moving over to Telegram. The group is moving over to Telegram. So if you need a pointer, just hit me up on Telegram and I can point you in the right direction.
Nice
night,
to everyone. See you all. See you. Ciao, ciao.
Good night.
Mm-hmm. Ciao.
Ciao, ciao.